Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Magnifico Radio, bringing you the latest in ethical fashion, clean beauty, and sustainable living. I'm your host, Kate Black, and this is episode 4. And today we're talking about slow fashion with designer Tara St. James. After stints as a designer for several denim and typical mall brands, my guest today launched her own brand, Study New York, here in Brooklyn in 2009. Study New York is dedicated to being a fashion brand that makes a difference. And she named the brand Study to bring her fans and clients along the ride while she studied alternatives in materials, methods of production, etc. And one thing has remained consistent in these 7 years, her dedication to slow fashion. And I'm thrilled to have her here today. Welcome to Tara St. James.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you.
We were both discussing that since we come from the land of the North, that today is actually our Thanksgiving. So before we talk about slow fashion, let's break down some of the terms. People know what fast food is, but maybe haven't heard the term fast fashion. What does fast fashion mean to you?
So essentially, it's very similar to fast food. It's being made or produced quickly with response to trendy items, which are increasingly fast and made with very little regard for the environment or social justice issues. So the opposite of that, which would be slow fashion, would be similar to the slow food movement. So made with responsible production methods, respect for the environment, respect for the people who are making the product, and a much slower response to all of those issues. So production itself being much slower and very little regard to trends.
Okay. And I've read some of your writings on slow fashion. Did you coin the term?
I absolutely did not coin the term, although I'd love to lay claim to it. I don't know who coined the term. I can tell you that.
Okay, and when did you start practicing it?
Inadvertently, I suppose, when I first started Study in 2009, with no understanding that there was a term. I'm not even sure there was at the time. It was called, I guess, green fashion.
Okay.
And there's been an evolution in terms throughout since then. But I think I in some ways started it with my first collection, which was zero waste, and made using environmentally responsible materials.
Okay. And the slow movement seems to have gained awareness and support globally for food. And to the point that the Slow Food International is able to rally against certain legislation like the TPP. Do you see a slow fashion movement gaining momentum?
I do. I see that through different certification bodies, for example, GOTS or the GOTS certification is starting to take precedent over not only the fiber and materials, but also the production methods. And so really covering from crop to the finished garment. So instead of crop to table, it would be crop to shirt.
Or sea to shelf,
as I've heard it coined.
Exactly. So in 2011, you were awarded the Eco Demani Fashion Foundation Grant for Sustainable Design.
That's right.
2013, your anti-fashion calendar was named one of Sustainia 100 Solutions for Sustainability, which is a global initiative spearheaded by Arnold Schwarzenegger.
That's right.
To promote innovative global solutions across all industries. Mm-hmm. And then in 2014, you were awarded runner-up in the CFDA Lexus Eco Fashion Challenge. Mm-hmm. Can we just break down some of those terms? Because this show, this is only our fourth episode, but we're going to talk a lot about fashion. And I think that these, for those of us in it, these terms are interchangeable, but not always. So what does sustainable design, when you were awarded that that Eco Demani for sustainable design, what did it mean then and what does it mean now?
First of all, just hearing that timeline laid out for me makes me realize it's time for something new to plug into.
I agree.
I think it's actually funny because the dialogue around sustainable fashion, and I should preface this with saying that the brand I worked on prior to study also used sustainable materials, but at the time we called it green fashion. And so looking back at the timeline, my trajectory really makes me realize that the way that people talk about sustainability in fashion kind of is a focus on how long they've been working in sustainable fashion, because 10 years ago we called it green. And green fashion was just a way to categorize organic materials. It was pretty much all it was. And then it transitioned into eco. And I think that's a good indication of when you came into the
Magnif Eco.
Yeah, exactly. And then after that, it started changing to sustainable. And now I think the term ethical is a little bit more prevalent or more commonly used, but they are interchangeable, fortunately and unfortunately. So fortunately, because it means that you can use different terms to try to categorize what you're doing as a designer, but unfortunately for the consumer, because I think it does confuse the consumer a little bit. There's so many different terms bouncing around, and I think originally we just looked at materials, and now we're looking at the entire supply chain. So not only the materials themselves and how they're grown, if they're natural, but also the type of labor that's being used, the type of transportation, the amount of waste that's being produced from the garment, how many garments, and how long they'll last. So we're looking at post-consumer issues too, like wearability, washing, the type of wash that needs to be done by the consumer. And so designers are starting to look at a holistic view of the product rather than just what type of material is being used for it.
That's true. And you didn't mention synthetics, but I know that there's been a lot of advance in that as well, like in terms of looking at the chemical inputs and outputs and making a synthetic material.
That's right. So my main focus is on natural fibers. I tend to use more organic cottons, linens, hemps, in my collection, wool as well. But there's huge steps in recycled polyester, for example.
Is that a design choice? Is that something that...
I think it's an aesthetic choice, primarily. Okay. I tend to gravitate more towards the natural fibers, but I certainly like a lot of the recycled that are out there, and if the product line just happens to come into play. So, for example, I want to make a rain jacket, which is on the works for next year, then I definitely gravitate towards the recycled polyesters.
Okay, interesting. So one of the other awards and accolades that you won was for an anti-fashion calendar.
That's
so
right.
Can you explain that for people who, I'm sure once you explain it, they'll understand it, but right off the bat, it's kind of like, what?
So the anti-fashion calendar is something that I implemented in 2013, and that I think really is when I started laying claim to the slow fashion movement and actually had the vocabulary to understand it as well. It's probably when I started understanding slow fashion. And it's also when I realized that the traditional fashion calendar of shipping two seasons a year, which is what I was doing prior to 2013, didn't make sense for my brand. So it may make sense for some brands, and I'm not saying that this is a solution for everyone, but it was something that just fell into place for me. It was more of following my instinct. I realized that producing two full collections every year and shipping them at the same time as every other designer just didn't make sense for me creatively, also financially, and was causing me to produce things that I didn't want to produce, and not produce things, or was stopping me from producing things that I did want to produce. So the example of that is I wanted to design something in November for the next collection, and I couldn't do it because there was no way in the calendar to allow me to do that. So I wasn't able to show it to my stores. I wasn't able to show it to customers. So I couldn't design something, which I thought was going to be really interesting. And I also found myself putting pieces in the line just to merchandise the line, when I didn't think that they were valuable. I thought they were just commodities that I was filling in blank slots for. And that's the way we're taught in school to do it, is to have a well-merchandised collection. It's the way we're taught in industry, to have a certain number of pieces. And it just didn't seem right to me. It didn't satisfy this aesthetic need that I had to be creative at certain times. And it forced me to be creative at other times. And so I started thinking about alternatives to that, and that's when the anti-fashion calendar came in. And so it's basically a rejection of the typical fashion calendar and an attempt at adopting something new. And so that's still sort of in the trial and error phase. And every year we weed out different problems with it and bring in different solutions. And so now what we've done is created a uniform collection, which is our bestsellers. And occasionally we'll change the fabrics of those or update them. And then to that, and really it does look like a uniform. So it can be merchandised together. It can all be worn together, mix and match. And it's not trendy items, so you can wear them all the time. And then to that, we add capsules. And so in the fall, we'll add a sweater collection of 3 or 4 items, coats, things like that, that are very seasonally driven. And then in the spring, we'll add lighter weight items.
Which is ideal because anybody who's starting to slow down their consumption mm-hmm. and start to buy fewer pieces, you find that you kind of gravitate towards, I read somewhere that if you looked at your laundry basket, you know, 20% of your wardrobe is always in there and it's getting 80% of the wear. So we're always kind of gravitated to certain clothes. And if you find something that's classic and works for your wardrobe, you go back the next season and it's gone, A, because it's now short sleeves instead of long sleeves or because the brand has moved on.
That's right.
But even when we talk about calendars, like from a consumer point of view, weren't you already slow? Like isn't two collections a year slow? And isn't that how we got into this idea about fast fashion?
Yeah. So at the time, two wasn't extremely slow, but it is considered that now. Slower, I suppose, but there was still that sense that you had to merchandise certain items in the line and you had to start over fresh every season and scrap your theme and scrap your fabrics and start completely fresh with a new mood board. And so I'm building on this uniform collection constantly and always keeping those in mind. And like you mentioned, they'll always be available. So customers who want to either replace them or buy a new fabric because they like the way that that piece fits and merchandises with their wardrobe can always find them. And then the stores can always replenish them. So it seemed counterintuitive to me as a designer and a product developer to be scrapping everything that I'd done, which is actually a very expensive process of developing patterns and sourcing fabrics and trying prototypes and tests and things like that. So scrapping that every season is really expensive for a designer, but we're forced to do it because of these unwritten rules that the industry has. And so it's saved me quite a bit of money in that sense, but it's also recreated a relationship with my stores and my individual consumers that I hadn't anticipated. And then the other benefit that it really created was being able to work with my production facility differently, because what they were doing at the time was laying off workers in the down season, times when they weren't producing, and bringing them back during the heavy production schedule, which is when everybody else is producing. And I know that because they're here in New York, so I can go see them. And so now they're producing my capsule collection and the uniform collection at different times of the year. So it's a constant supply chain for them as well.
No wonder it won an award. That's fantastic. And you're also now have been renowned lately for zero waste, another kind of way to kind of reduce the waste that a designer contributes to the industry and to the world. Can you explain what zero waste is and what the benefits are?
Yeah. So the way I interpret zero waste is I always call it lazy zero waste, because you look at designers like Holly McQuillan or Timo Riisinen, who have a book about this, a very great book I'll mention. And the way I approach it is with squares and rectangles, using the full width of the fabric. And then I pleat those squares or gather them. But I'm not cutting into them really, except for to add pockets and things. But it's really based on squares. And actually my first collection in 2009 was called The Square Project, and it was entirely zero waste. And I've moved a little bit away from that, but there are still styles in the collection that are zero waste, and that I'm continually making. And we keep all of our scraps. So any waste that is produced from our traditional collection, we reuse either by cutting it into strips and weaving them. So we're working with an organization called Weaving Hand in Brooklyn, and they're a healing arts organization, and they do a collaboration with us every time we have these waste scraps.
And anybody who's a sewist or sews at home knows when you lay the pattern out and you cut out that there's all this kind of off cuts. Mm-hmm. And so the same thing happens at the industrial level. Mm-hmm. What do you think would happen to the industry as a whole if the whole industry could move a little bit more? I mean, it requires obviously engineers. It requires bringing in different kind of brains into the pattern making supply chain. But what do you think would happen if the whole industry could just take one step closer to zero waste?
Well, for one thing, it would save a lot of money. Because the industry average for a good pattern marker is about 15% waste. And that's a good one. That's an efficient marker, which is the way you lay out your pattern and put it on the fabric and cut. And so you're losing 15% of your fabric. And if that's an expensive fabric, that could be quite a lot of waste. And most factories don't save that. It just goes straight to landfill. And in New York, that's a substantial amount of landfill coming from our manufacturing. So there are some solutions like Fab Scrap and then ultimately Evernew. That are trying to deal with this production waste. However, I think it really does need to be tackled at the design level and at the production level. So even prior to the manufacturing, we need to start looking at the way our products are designed and start to eliminate waste at that level.
I love it. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and talk more with Tara St. James of Study New York.
Music in this break is by EULA. The song is called Awake. We'll be right back.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
And you're back. You're listening to Magnifico Radio, and I'm sitting here with Tara St. James of Study New York, and we're talking about slow fashion. And normally I like to know if people grew up with hippie parents or have some sort of parental influence that led to this path. But in your case, I want to know, did you go to an artsy school or did you grow up in a chic neighborhood of Montreal?
I would have to say no to both those questions.
Because one of your classmates is also a leader in fashion. Mm-hmm. You and Caroline Issa have been friends since high school, and you've both risen to acclaim. You've won the awards I mentioned earlier, and Caroline, after several years as a model, now is the editor of Tank Magazine, is a regular in the front row on the Global Fashion Week circuit. In fact, this week she's at Tokyo Fashion Week. Mm-hmm. And I reached out to her to ask her what she thinks makes you and Study so different. Oh, and so she wrote, "You know, for me, Tara is one of those true visionaries who, since the beginning of her career in fashion, always questioned the status quo and always kept in mind how best to incorporate sustainable practices. What amazes me is how quietly and surely she has stuck to her principles and ideas on how fashion could be run, and only when it became fashionable, in quotes, did the accolades start coming in. She was born ready, but the industry wasn't."
Oh, thanks, Kara.
I know, it's very sweet. Mm-hmm. So I want to know, this visionary aspect, has it been with you since the start, and where did it come from?
Well, I think I am just naturally inclined to question things. It's in my nature. You asked about my high school. I was captain of the debate team on high school, so I like to argue a lot. And I always like to know why and how things work. So It did seem natural. I worked in the traditional fashion industry for, I guess, 6 or 7 years before starting Covet, which was a sustainable brand. And that was under the umbrella of a larger company. So I was lucky to be able to do research and sustainability through with their production facilities. And as I slowly started to learn the, I guess, effects of conventional fashion on the environment, and I should preface this with saying that I was traveling to Hong Kong and mainland China 4 times a year for production. So I was on the ground there really seeing what was happening and seeing who was working on the product. And I was lucky enough to work with really some great production facilities, but at the same time, they were right next door to some not so great ones. And so I really had firsthand viewpoint of the detrimental effects of the fashion industry, especially in the denim world. Denim is one of the highest polluting industries, especially when back then we were looking at sandblasted and wash jeans. Now the trend is more in the raw denim, which is a lot cleaner because we're not sandblasting them, we're not bleaching them, we're not acid washing them. But at the time, that was definitely the case. And so I learned a lot about the effects of conventional cotton. And once I learned the differences between conventional and organic, it was really hard to unlearn that information. And so just by nature, I couldn't, in my conscience, go back to traditional. And so it was almost like I had no choice. I was being pulled in this direction. And I'm not the product of hippie parents, but I am Canadian. So I suppose there's something there that's just inherent.
I say that too often, and people kind of look at me with that, you know, sideways dog look, like, what do you mean Canadian? But I think that there is something in the way that we grew up and having so much nature in our backyard. So aside from the accolades, what are the opportunities or benefits from being so fixed in your vision? You've been doing this now since 2009.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the advantages of really crafting a business and a life based on the values that you believe in?
I really like, well, I suppose the accolades are one, but like I said, I don't see it as a choice. I have no alternative. It's either I design sustainably and ethically or I don't design at all. So those are my two options. So I guess the benefit is that I get to actually design product. That's the benefit because that's what I feel I was born to do. There is something called design guilt that I may have coined this term because I haven't heard anyone use it, but everybody who works in the ethical community understands it as soon as I talk about it. Is just this guilt of producing something and making more product and putting it out on the market and then going back to the drawing board and doing it again and using natural resources or any resources, using labor when maybe it's not necessary, because there is enough clothing out there for all of us for a long, long time. We don't actually need to be making more clothing. But by the same token, I need to be a happy person. And that's my contribution to this planet, is me walking around as a happy person. And designing and producing makes me happy. So I need to be doing those things ethically so that I can live with myself and wake up in the morning and be content with what I'm doing. So I don't see it as a benefit. I just see it as a non-option.
Like breathing.
Yeah.
Basically.
Kind.
And so because now you have this knowledge, and I talk about it a lot with people, especially around my book, because my book shocks a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And it says right in the beginning, you know, be very careful because you can't unknow what you learn. So what are there any drawbacks now to this having building a career that's kind of like restricted or kind of set up by the values that you have?
Of course, and I suppose the biggest one is being restricted or limited in my options, especially with regards to materials. Because if I walk the fabric trade shows or I go to a showroom and look at the new collections of materials, I'm really limited to the ones that are being made ethically. I have the good fortune of working with some great fabric mills who only produce ethical fabrics, and so I tend to gravitate just towards them because then I know everything that I'm selecting has been carefully made. However, it does happen where I am exposed to some great fabric that has no sustainable component at all, and it's really limiting. As a designer, I want to be able to use great raw materials, and sometimes I can't. And so that's probably my biggest frustration. You know, people talk about cost being prohibitive, and I don't think that's the case. I think being an emerging designer or a small brand, your costs are ultimately going to be higher. So the increased cost of organic cotton really doesn't make a difference in the long run, because I'm not producing enough to see that difference anyway.
And so you've also, and we didn't really touch on this, but you've also embraced transparency. You're one of the few designers out there, in fact, maybe even the first designer, to totally open up your supply chain and post it on the website. So if there are emerging designers, of which we know many, who are like, oh, I just wish I knew where to get organic cotton, mm-hmm. you actually put all of that, which is so antithetical to what the fashion industry does typically, because mm-hmm. all of those things are have been typically secrets and trade secrets and closed secrets, but you reveal everything on mm-hmm. the website. What is there any drawback to that?
There has been. Part of the reason I did it was because I do believe in open source as the new philosophy in design, maybe not necessarily fashion, but in traditional design. And one of the main reasons was that I was getting a lot of calls and emails from design students, young designers, asking me for my supply chain. And I have no problem sharing it because I want the, you know, I'm spending a lot of time vetting these suppliers, and I want the ones that I think are doing good to get out there and have a viable business. And I'm not going to be able to support them all by myself. And so if they can be accessed by this other community of designers, it just actually saved me a lot of time by putting all the information on my website so that I don't have to answer these emails as frequently anymore. But also I think it's important for consumers to know where their product is coming from. And I think if I'm putting out where the fabric is made, if I know where the cotton is grown, I'll put it there. It's not always easy to find that out, but where the fabric is made, how it's dyed, and then where the piece is sewn. And every one of my garments is hand-signed by the sewer, so you see the person's name. And there's a little bit of a touch of humanity there, and it's not just a pre-printed label, but it is, you know, hand-marked, hand-signed by a human. And I think people forget that garments are sewn by hand. Everything is made by hand. It's made on an industrial machine, of course, but there still needs to be a human being operating that. And I think with technology being what it is, we forget that sometimes, because we don't make anything at home anymore. Our grandmothers aren't making it for us anymore. And so we don't have that connection with clothing. And so I wanted to give that back to my consumers a little bit and hopefully have them ask questions of other brands when they don't see the transparency, because I think it should be the norm.
I do too. And I love it because I think it's just that one step forward that kind of differentiates lip service about transparency with actual transparency, because I think you can say that you do it, but we all know updating a website takes time, and even myself. So when you take the time to actually sit down and update the website with that information, then I don't know, it's just an extra step that I think is really special about you and the brand.
Thank you.
So now that you've taken all of this attention and all this, attention that goes into the brand, how big do you think the brand can grow, or how, where do you want to see it in the next kind of like 3-5 years?
That is actually one of my biggest struggles, because I do really believe in slow fashion, and I don't want the brand to grow to such a huge place that I can't control it anymore. Originally, I thought that it could be a mega brand, and that I've thrown that idea out the window. And I really want the brand to grow very organically, to develop a really consistent customer base, which I'm starting to see, you know, repeat customers, people who come back, who understand the brand, who respect it, and see how far it can grow there. I think there are a lot of opportunities. I think menswear might be one of the next big tackles. It's actually my background. I studied menswear, and so my degree is in tailoring. And I think that's pretty obvious when you look at all the fabric choices I make. They're very menswear driven, so it's not a surprise to people when I tell them that. But I think the future of my customer base is really in the unisex and menswear brand. So I think I'll probably take it in that direction. But I have no philosophies on being huge, or being a mega brand, because I don't think that's what the future holds for me.
Medium size? Sold at every Whole Foods across North America?
Oh, definitely not, no.
Why not? Especially your twist dress. Like, you make this fantastic classic dress. It's totally affordable. What's the consumer price on that?
It's $110 US.
Yeah, and what's it made out of?
Organic cotton from Texas.
Amazing. Yeah. It's so amazing. I love the fact that you have this price range. I love the fact that you keep something so simple as a dress, like, affordable and really timeless. So even though it's not affordable in the H&M terms or in a fast fashion terms, it's definitely, I think, for organic cotton made locally with attention to transparency and slow fashion, it's a very reasonable piece that would be in your wardrobe for a long time.
Oh, that's a perfect example of one of our uniform pieces as well, because we've perfected it over the years, and now I think it's gotten to a point where it's really great to wear. It suits a lot of different customers, and I'll keep making it until people stop buying it.
Oh, that's awesome. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's been my pleasure to talk to you about this. If you want to find out more about Tara, please go to studynewyork.com. I'd love to shout out to Roberta's Home of Heritage Radio Network, where you can find me each Monday live at 1 o'clock. You can always listen to Magnifico Radio on iTunes or Stitcher. And please check out our blog or sign up for our newsletter at magnifico.com. Until next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.